It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a bipartisan pair of lawmakers discuss their new bill that would give victims of clergy abuse more time to file civil lawsuits. Now, Governor Tony Evers and Republican state lawmakers announced a deal last week on a local government funding bill that would revamp the shared revenue system in Wisconsin. The agreement comes after negotiations over how much state aid should increase for communities and what restrictions and concessions should come along with it. Among other things, the bill would give Milwaukee more flexibility to raise local sales tax to avoid looming financial trouble while also providing more funding for school choice vouchers. That aspect was a high priority for Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who announced the deal at a press conference on Thursday.
We will have transformational school choice expansions. We will have money for public schools. We will have more money for all of the local government services that we know are priorities. And on top of that, we have a large number of conservative wins with things that we have struggled to get across the finish line before that are all part of a very comprehensive bill that will really showcase the good things that happen in Wisconsin.
In a statement, Governor Evers called the bill a compromise that will be, quote, transformative for our communities and our state. Milwaukee city and county leaders praised the funding in the bill while expressing dissatisfaction with other parts of the legislation. You could join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the shared revenue deal? What questions do you have about it? Do you think this was a fair compromise? What kind of impact could more state funding have on your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Mark O'Connell is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Counties Association. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Good to be on the show, Rob.
And Ross Milton is an assistant professor of public affairs at UW-Madison. His research focuses on the political economy and public finance of state and local taxes. Ross, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ross, can you explain the basics? People don't see the words shared revenue written on local services. How much, though, does it affect our communities?
It's a major piece of funding for local governments all across the state of Wisconsin. And I think states transfer resources to local governments in different ways in different states. But in most states, money that comes from the state in one fashion is a major source of revenues for local governments. And in Wisconsin, the major way that's done is through this shared revenue system.
Mark,
so these changes will have a big impact in many places.
Mark, we've talked about cities and other local governments. How about counties? How do you describe the need that was out there from counties to get more shared revenue from the state?
Well, counties are really an extension of the state in terms of providing services. Our state lawmakers and governor evaluate what needs or desires the citizens have and then pass legislation or programs which meet those needs or desires. They then ask state agencies to perform the function. When the state agencies need statewide outreach, many times they will ask the counties to perform the function. Sometimes money goes with it, sometimes sufficient money, and sometimes insufficient money. When it's insufficient, property taxes make up the difference. So this particular piece of legislation, transferring dollars from the state to the counties and cities, towns, and villages as well, is a major piece of legislation which will definitely have an impact on the citizens of Wisconsin and their property tax bills.
As you look at it from that county perspective, Mark, what we're seeing in this deal, how would county governments around the state be affected?
Yeah, this is one of the most transformative elements of this particular piece of legislation is the linkage of state revenues to local units of government being tied to the state's economy. In other words, currently, local units of government primarily rely on the property tax for funding. That has some loose relationship with the economy, but not direct. What this legislation is doing is taking 1 cent of the sales tax and allocating it to local units of government. And as sales tax collections go up, 2, 3, 4, or in some cases even higher, percent, so too will the allocation to local governments. That single piece of this legislation links our revenues at the local level to the state's economy. What that really does is it creates all of us at the local government level wanting what the state wants, more people making more money, engaged in more commerce, paying more in taxes at current or even lower rates, so we can take those dollars as locals, invest them in our communities to make them attractive to the smart young wealth makers of tomorrow.
And Ross, this deal, and I think you've said this elsewhere, was a long awaited. I think a lot of people felt like something needed to change. It was overdue. Can you talk about the need for lawmakers and the governor to tackle this?
Sure. The shared revenue program has been cut and or neglected repeatedly over the last 20 years. And so if in terms of how much resources local governments are getting today relative to what they were getting 20 years ago, if you adjust for inflation, it's a dramatic decrease. And for many local governments, even with this large sounding increase that is being proposed today, will actually not bring them back in real inflation adjusted terms to where they were in 2003.
Talking to Ross Milton, professor at UW-Madison, and Mark O'Connell with the Wisconsin Counties Association, looking in this agreement between Governor Evers and Republican leaders in the legislature over an update to the shared revenue plan. Still has to be passed by the legislature. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Mark is with us in Wauwatosa. Mark, hi.
Hi. Yes, a Hoosier by birth from Indiana, but a Badger living in Wisconsin the last quarter century. Property in both states, residential house. It's going to be so much more expensive here. There was an article in today's Journal Sentinel that said that Milwaukee, if the property tax goes higher, as the politicians just agreed at the state level, that without a referendum, that we'll be on par with other major cities. What the Journal Sentinel article did not state today was it did not compare the property tax. I know that in Indiana, property tax is 1% of assessed value for residential. So it's 2% for vacation homes. It's 3% for commercial property. And we pay, anywhere from 2 to 4 times higher property tax here in Wisconsin.
Gotcha, Mark. Thanks for the call. Ross, Mark mentioning the sales tax increase approved for Milwaukee without a referendum requiring a 2/3 vote, I believe, from the county board and the city government. How do we compare in Wisconsin in our reliance on property taxes, as Mark was saying, versus other forms of revenue?
Wisconsin's very unusual in that our local governments receive very, very little revenue from sales taxes, and instead are almost the only tax instrument that local governments really have any local control over is the property tax. I mean, and that's unusual. In most states, local governments have the ability to raise revenue via both sales taxes and property taxes. It all varies across states how that exactly works. But we're unusual in that respect. And so this proposal does change that somewhat, all but only for Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, and it would allow them to use a sales tax as well.
Thanks for that call, Mark. And Mark O'Connell with the Counties Association, do you feel like this deal gives counties not named Milwaukee County enough flexibility, enough local control over their fiscal fates?
Well, maybe not so much control, but it does link our revenues to the economy. So we all have a vested interest in a very successful, vibrant economy. In Wisconsin, we're very high in property taxes compared to the rest of the nation. We're relatively low on sales taxes, and we're somewhere in the middle on income taxes. What this is doing in a small way, at least in the city and county of Milwaukee, it is changing that mix a little. I think we're going to see later in this budget, we'll see some adjustments in tax policy, probably in the income tax area, but that will have the effect of changing our mix somewhat at the state level.
Thanks for that call. Mary Kay joins us next in Kenosha. Mary Kay, hello.
Hi. I was hoping that the cities and counties would finally hire program monitors for our WEDA, because WEDA does absolutely nothing for subsidized housing. And taxpayers are paying for things that they wouldn't believe are not getting done. And I'm talking for nonprofits here. So it's about time they took some of the money and started fixing up the properties and started, you know, having those people become accountable, because they're just wasting our tax dollars.
Mary Kay, thanks for the call. Housing and economic development funding. Mark, what kind of oversight is there at the county level anyway when state funding via WEDA and other programs gets spent at the county level?
Well, the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, WEDA, is an entity that has very little state funding injected into it. WEDA is more or less kind of a self-sufficient operation where they work with developers and housing authorities to create housing, which has very little interface or rub up against local units of government. We certainly have facilities within our boundaries that are WEDA funded, but we don't really have oversight of that. And quite frankly, the issues that are the bond issuances that WEDA might engage in to create a housing development is sort of a one-time thing. There's certainly follow-up, but the actual operation of a housing unit or complex, that is wouldn't necessarily fall under the authority of WEDA, but it might be more of a private sector developer issue.
Thanks for calling in, Mary Kay. We're talking to Wisconsin Counties Association President Mark O'Connell and UW-Madison Public Affairs Professor Ross Milton about the shared revenue deal here in Wisconsin reached between Governor Evers and Republican leaders in the state legislature, still advancing through the legislature now. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What would it mean for your community to get some more money back from the state? How do you feel about some of the restrictions, the strings attached? We'll get into that a little on how that money can be spent. Do you like this compromise? Do you have questions about it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up the conversation about Wisconsin's shared revenue system, an agreement between legislative Republicans and Governor Tony Evers. Our guests are Wisconsin Counties Association President Mark O'Connell and UW-Madison Public Affairs Professor Ross Milton. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the shared revenue deal, what it could mean for your community? How do you want to see increased state aid used by your local government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ross, there are some strings attached. What are some of the rules for how this increased funding could be spent by local governments that receive it? What stands out to you?
Well, I think that this is a big change in the way the shared revenue system is thought of. You know, historically, the shared revenue system has been unrestricted aid to local governments that had no strings attached in terms of how they were intended to use it. Whereas the proposal that we have now for the increases in aid are intended to be used primarily for public safety related expenses. And that is, I think, a fundamental change that you can argue for it, you can argue against it, but it is a big change.
Mark, what do you think of that change in particular?
Yeah, the restrictions, or I guess directed use of the revenue for public safety and transportation, it's a pretty wide range of items on which we can spend funds. 911, dispatch, courts, public transportation infrastructure. That is quite a bit of what local government does. So it is a change from being unrestricted, but it is still providing a fair amount of flexibility. I think one thing that we should not lose sight of, Rob, this while the legislature and the governor aren't necessarily dinner party partners, they've agreed on this issue. So Speaker Voss, Senator LeMahieu, Senator Felskowski, Representative Kurtz, and Tony Evers all came together from different parts of the political spectrum to say, we need to provide dollars to local government so they can improve their communities, make them attractive to the talent, which is our number one resource for private sector profit in our new millennium knowledge technology-based economy. They've seen the future. And this, quite frankly, this legislation is very visionary. And I think we will look back 10, 15, 20 years from now and say, back in 2022, we saw what needed to get done and did it. And it's going to put our state in a much better place.
Add to what Mark was saying about the flexibility that it does provide, you know, for many local governments, those restrictions may not end up being all that meaningful because they already spend a lot of money on those topics. And so they have that now they have these earmarked funds for those expenditures, and that frees up other money to be spent in other ways. So for some local governments, it may not make much difference.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Eagle River. Jeff, hi.
Hi. I was kind of somewhat amused by the conversations that are going on here. The original purpose of the shared revenue formula, was to be able to return the largest that the state of Wisconsin received vis-a-vis the income taxes that it generated from the people that live within the municipalities and the counties in the state of Wisconsin. And that formula was established to be fair and equally distributed among those taxpayers for the purpose of property tax relief. Now, what's going on right now is kind of like a I just sort of call it visionary. It's not visionary. If they were to go back to the old formula back in the 1980s and the early 1990s, prior to the changes that were made by the Republican-controlled legislature, they would see that there more money would be returned into the municipalities for the purpose of alleviating the property tax. You know, they use that money for other things now. They got the shared revenue program instead of returning it to municipalities, and they use it for spending in other areas. The purpose of the program was to relieve the property tax, to help offset that burden of the caller from was talking about Indiana, you know, as an example. It seems to me that, you know, they need to establish a formula that is, has a growth factor, associated with the increase in state revenues.
Jeff, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Ross, does Jeff have the history about right and how that formula didn't end up working ultimately the way we wanted it to originally?
It's certainly the case that the shared revenue system had the effect of alleviating property taxes, but the intent originally was to compensate local governments for lost tax revenue due to state legislation that decreased the ability of local governments to tax certain types of property and to tax income when the state created the income tax system. And so that's approximately right. And over time, in the last couple of decades, the shared revenue formula hasn't been updated, and cuts have been made. And so it hasn't been transferring as much money to local governments. And so if local governments wanted more revenue, they went to the property tax, the only tool that they had. And so that's definitely true.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Ross Milton from UW-Madison and Mark O'Connell with the Wisconsin Counties Association, looking at this shared revenue plan agreed to by a Democratic governor, Republican leaders in the legislature, now making its way through that legislature. Mark, I wanted to ask, with the Counties Association, counties come in a lot of shapes and especially sizes here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about some of the different challenges facing counties with the different resources to work with in the first place?
Oh, yeah. And it refers to, go back to something Jeff indicated, the previous caller. The shared revenue formula, as Ross indicated, hasn't really been run for almost two decades. And so it's very hard to put some dollars into a formula and then rerun it without having several, people that are going to get less, losers, you might call them. The time to revamp the formula is when you can make sure there are no losers to get it done politically. That's part of what was being done with this piece of legislation. We've had counties that, if you would run the formula, would be getting much more. Maybe the best example of that is Waukesha. They're a large county, but they get a very small dollar amount in terms of shared revenue. If we were going to rerun the formula, they would do much, much better. At the same time, you may have some smaller counties that are getting a substantial portion of shared revenue, but if you reran the formula, might not get as much. So when we infuse a fair amount of dollars like this legislation does, you can ensure that everyone gets something. Is it enough? Is it fair? Not really when it comes to a formula, because we're not really running a formula again. We're sort of adding dollars and evening things out among cities, towns, villages, counties, and then saying that's your new base. Now you're going to get increases, as Jeff indicated, as the economy does better, sales tax collections go up, then you in your city, town, village, county will also get that same percentage increase in your new base. So it's not perfect, but very few things in politics are. But it's as perfect as it could get in a very complex piece of legislation.
Ross, I wanted to ask about the sustainability of this system. We've got a budget surplus now, so we had some money to work with. Mark mentioned as the economy gets better, things look better. Economies get worse sometimes. Are we going to be in a situation in 2 or 5 or 10 years potentially where this formula runs up against the shoals and we have a big problem with it again?
Well, so I think part of the reason that we haven't, that it has been decreasing over the last 20 years is that the previous system didn't really have any mechanism through which it automatically increased over time. And as so it was up to the legislature to pass a new law saying that, well, we're going to increase total funding for shared revenues by 5% next year. And that by and large didn't happen. And so as Mark has pointed out, like I think the very nice feature of this is that there is some aspect in which it will automatically increase over time, keyed to how state sales tax revenue goes up. And so if sales tax revenue goes up, that will, you know, benefit local governments. If sales tax revenue doesn't increase over time from one year to another, then there wouldn't be increase in share revenue.
We'll leave it there. Ross, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark, thanks for being with us.
Rob, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Been talking to Mark O'Connell, president and CEO of the Wisconsin Counties Association, and Ross Milton, assistant professor of public affairs at UW-Madison, who researches public finance and state and local taxes. They join us for a look at the shared revenue deal announced by Governor Evers and leading Republicans in the state legislature. Still now has to work its way through the legislature to be passed in its final form. Love to hear from you. Is there a part of this deal you want to hear more about, either from us on Central Time or from the WPR news team? Are you wondering how maybe something in your own community is affected? You can email your question, your point of curiosity, over to ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org, and we can give it a look in the future. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get an update on a pipeline project here in Wisconsin and the legal battles that have been surrounding it ongoing. The latest on Line 5. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a bipartisan pair of lawmakers tell us about a new bill that would give survivors of clergy abuse more time to file civil lawsuits. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. 43 years ago this month, almost 15,000 Cuban refugees were sent to live in southwest Wisconsin. WPR dove into the history of this situation and the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a preview of the podcast, which explores the lives of Cubans in Wisconsin.
Imagine, you're a 16-year-old kid thousands of miles from home. You've just stepped off a plane in Wisconsin. For the next few months, you'll be living at an army base. There are strangers, people who don't speak your language. It feels like you're living in prison. Your whole world has been uprooted. You think you're alone, far from family and friends, when suddenly you discover your father, who you've barely had a relationship with, is also at this military base in Wisconsin. This was the reality for Armando Rodriguez, who left his barracks at Fort McCoy daily to meet with his father, Guillermo Rodriguez.
I saw my dad on the other side of the fence, and we talked from afar. And we spent about a month and some like that.
Armando and Guillermo are from Cuba and had to live at Fort McCoy until they found a home in the United States. They were here in Sparta, Wisconsin, because of the Mariel boat lift. For 5 months in 1980, the Cuban government opened its borders and let its residents leave for the U.S. during the height of the Cold War. Almost 125,000 Cubans fled the island and landed in South Florida by boat.
She says more craft are expected to make the journey in what could build into a Dunkirk-like evacuation.
Because of that, the president yesterday declared a state of emergency in southern Florida.
There's a hopeful feeling that they will be allowed to stay in this country and to find jobs.
Many refugees left their homeland to find a better opportunity or escape Fidel Castro's communist government. Some wanted to be reunited with family. Others were plucked from jail and pushed onto boats.
We arrived here in Key West, and then we arrived at Fort McCoy. In Fort McCoy, I stayed for 5 months.
Armando was one of the nearly 15,000 people sent to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin before he found a home. Most of the Cubans who came to Wisconsin left the area after connecting with family or finding sponsors. But some people, like Armando, remained in southern Wisconsin. They created lives here as bus drivers, fathers, and musicians. Now, 42 years later, many of the refugees want to visit Cuba. People like Armando want to go just one more time, but they can't.
I've never been able to visit Cuba. I would like to visit Cuba. I'm not allowed to go. And if I go, I can't come back. I'm in the same situation as everyone else who has committed a crime.
His friends in Wisconsin feel the same.
I'm 63 years old. Wow, times go fast, you know. And I haven't given up. I have faith.
The immigration, you know, give us a second chance. Why can those Cubans get a second chance?
Do you want to go back and visit also?
Yeah, I want to go see my mama before she died.
I can go to Cuba.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, I can go. Because I was lucky. I never committed a crime. The only problem is when I want to do my passport, I talk to my sister to send my birth certificate. And when I see my birth certificate, that's wrong. That's not my name.
Because when I tried to kill him, I always say, you know, the reason I did it because I want to go back to Cuba.
I'm Maureen McCollum, and this is Uprooted, a new podcast from Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll hear from Cuban Wisconsinites who arrived here more than 40 years ago. These are the unheard voices behind the headlines. What were their lives like in Cuba? What was the journey like across the sea? What has life been like in Wisconsin? And after 40 years, where do they go from here? Subscribe to Uprooted wherever you get your podcasts, and you can see more at WPR.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
To find the Uprooted podcast, go to Season 3 of WPR Reports, wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, a bipartisan group of lawmakers is introducing a new bill that would raise the time limit for survivors of clergy abuse to file civil lawsuits. The bill would increase the statute of limitations for survivors by 10 years, from age 35 to 45. The bill comes as a number of other states this year are changing time limits on these civil suits in clergy abuse cases. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this change? Should there be a statute of limitations for survivors of clergy abuse to sue? How do you feel about the current level of state support for victims? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Melissa Agard is a Democratic state senator from Madison representing the 16th District. Senator Agard, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Jesse James is a Republican state senator from Altoona representing the 23rd District. Senator James, thanks for joining us again.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Senator James, can you talk about this 10-year change, age 35 to 45, why that particular number?
Well, I think bringing parity to our civil statutes meeting our criminal statutes just makes common sense and it's logical. I don't see why we couldn't get this done. Plus, with victims, timelines, and recollections and memories and stuff aren't always prevalent like right then and there. There's stuff that happens, and for them to have the opportunity, the 10 years to match the criminal versus civil, I think just makes sense.
And Senator Agard, some advocates say, hey, why not get rid of the statute of limitations in the first place, as some states are looking at doing? Why not go all the way in that direction?
Well, we know that for far too long, there have been legal barriers that have halted the justice and healing process for survivors of sexual violence in Wisconsin, and especially our kids. And it's past time that we act and make sure that we're providing providing folks the path to healing so that they can take care of themselves. And, you know, they're part of legislating is compromise. Is this the bill that I originally drafted? No. Am I thrilled that Senator James is willing to walk through this path with me and lift up these stories? Yes. Am I hopeful that we can get to a point where all survivors are able to have that type of closure? Certainly. But I am proud of the work, the bipartisan work that is happening here. And I am grateful for the brave survivors who are able to share their stories and help us usher this through. And we'll cheer them on as they continue to pave the path.
Senator James, you chair the Senate's Children and Families Committee. Can you talk about the timeline for bringing this bill through the committee and to the whole legislature?
Yeah, very good question. I appreciate the question. Right now, we're so from moving from the Assembly to the Senate and the requirements of legislation for our budget motions to go through the Joint Finance Committee, where we've been strictly focusing on bills that pertain to the budget. As soon as the budget is done, we're going to move forward and get a hearing on this Child Victims Act bill.
Senator Aagaard, can you talk about the bipartisan work on this? People don't necessarily think of bipartisan cooperation in the legislature. I'm talking to a Democrat and a Republican right now about this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and frankly, this bill predates my time in the legislature. I've been in the legislature for a little over a decade at this point in time. And I know that there have been broad support of a coalition of people who have been rolling up their sleeves and working very hard to make sure that we're supporting children of survivors of sexual violence in the state of Wisconsin. I think we can all agree that it is an important job of legislators to make sure that our communities are safe, especially safe for our kids. And knowing that we have champions on both sides of the aisle to continue this conversation is really refreshing. And I look forward to being able to have this bill come to a hearing, you know, probably early this fall, as Senator James said, and inviting survivors into the Capitol building to share their stories. And, you know, I think it's also really important for people across Wisconsin to know that, you know, this bill, this is something that we absolutely need to get across the finish line, but there's not one piece of legislation that is going to cure the harm that has been given to people in our communities, as well as knowing that there are other policies we can do to also prevent harm. And being able to have these conversations in a bipartisan manner, knowing that there are legislators of different political flavors that are prioritizing this, I think should give the people of Wisconsin some hope.
Senator James, when there have been past efforts to completely remove that timeline for civil suits, some religious organizations have objected, saying, hey, this could do severe financial harm to religious institutions, ultimately harming current parishioners, not just, you know, the past perpetrators of these acts. Do you want to address those concerns if people of faith groups may be fearing more lawsuits that could hurt their local place of worship?
You know, I have to agree with Senator Aagaard. This is something where our children are impacted by this. And I take it very serious. We have to fight for our youth that don't have strong enough voices at the age of when incidents like this occur. No matter whether it's religious affiliation, family affiliation, you know, There's victims that I've dealt with directly that have been dramatically impacted by these sexual acts for their entire life. And that's where it comes down to, I think, bringing some form of remedy, adding the 10 years to the civil is just a way to go, regardless of the church state of mind and concern.
And Senator Aagaard, as we wrap up, are there other things you want to see pass through the legislature to do what Senator James was talking about, provide some level of redress for victims of past clergy abuse?
Absolutely. There is a handful of policies that I have been outspoken about over the years. One addressing healthy relationships and dating violence for young people within our communities, the good touch, bad touch for younger kids as well. Those are two bills. And another, you know, making sure, and this one is a little bit trickier for some members of both of Senator James and my caucuses, is holding our clergy accountable as mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect in the same way that we would for physicians and healthcare providers, school teachers and staff, counselors and social workers. I do not think that an exemption for clergy there is the right thing for the state of Wisconsin. Our kids are our most valuable resource, and having one of the most important jobs of government, ensuring safety of our children is paramount.
We'll leave it there. Senator Aagaard, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
And Senator James, thanks for being with us.
So thank you for having me. Have a great day.
You too. That was Jesse James, Republican State Senator from Altoona, and Melissa Aagaard, Democratic State Senator from Madison. They joined us for a look at their new legislation that would extend the timeline for civil lawsuits for survivors of clergy sexual abuse in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll get a reaction from a national group of abuse survivors, and you can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Do you support this change in the law we've been talking about? Does it go far enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about a proposed state law that would extend the timeline for civil lawsuits filed by survivors of sexual abuse by clergy. The law would change the current cap from age 35 to age 45. What would you like to know about how states are handling clergy abuse? Are you a survivor yourself? If you'd care to share your story, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Melanie Sakota joins us now, Survivor Support Coordinator for the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. Melanie, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, we just heard from this bipartisan pair of lawmakers working to extend that statute of limitations from age 35 to age 45 to be able to file that lawsuit for survivors of clergy abuse. What's your reaction to this proposal?
I think any progress in that direction is great. My ideal would be that there would be no criminal and no civil statute of limitations for child sex abuse.
How much are states moving in that direction toward just lifting that limitation to begin with?
I think the movement is in that direction. You've seen some states have achieved it already. Some states are working towards it. I live in California. California has a bill before the state legislature now to eliminate the civil statute of limitations. So that's what the trend is, because people have recognized, I think, two different things. One, that research and studies show that it can take survivors decades to come forward with their stories, to understand what happened to them, to remember it, and to have the courage to come forward. And what you want is you want these people to come forward, because when the more we know about who the abusers are, the better able we are to protect children. And unfortunately, those who abuse children often are not stopped as they age. So we want as many of the people as possible who have abused to become known.
How many more people might be eligible to file a lawsuit if we raise that age from 35 to 45 or 50s or beyond? How common is it for people to come forward at later ages?
Studies show that the average age for someone to come forward is 52, which means that you will have some people coming forward below that age and some people waiting until their 60s or 70s. I think the oldest I've heard of is someone in their 80s coming forward for the first time. So you want those windows to be open for two reasons. You want, number one, so you know who the abusers are, so people can protect themselves. And number two, so that other survivors who may have been abused by the same perpetrator can also have an opportunity to know that they were not the only ones. A lot of survivors feel that it was something that they did, that they are, and that they're the only ones this has happened to. So whenever you have someone coming forward and getting names out in the public, other people can begin their healing journey by saying, oh, it happened to me too.
Part of the goal is to hold individual perpetrators accountable. How important are these kind of lawsuits, though, when it comes to holding an institution accountable, maybe a religious organization that that didn't do its job at keeping its own members in line?
I think they're extremely important. They're the main reason why institutions have begun any changes to help protect children within their institutions. And it's going to have to, I think it hurts them where they feel it. It hurts them in their bottom line. And it also provides the secondary help to the survivors. Mental health care in this country is not often within reach of the average person. It's expensive. And this can help people on their healing journey by providing them with the resources they need to get the help that they need.
As a survivor support coordinator at the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, what kind of help do you see people needing? What are the best ways to support people who are victims of clergy abuse?
I think the best way to do is to listen to them, to believe them, to tell them that you're sorry for what happened, that it wasn't their fault. There are different groups, such as our group. We offer peer-to-peer support. We have leaders in different states that they are welcome to call or email and talk to about what they're going through. We also have a wide variety of virtual support groups, which means that they can talk with a whole group of other survivors about what they experienced and see where it's similar, where it's different, share ideas for what helps with issues, what do other people do about depression, insomnia, anxiety, and then pick from those ideas to see what works best for them to heal themselves.
Now, Wisconsin, sadly, no exception when it comes to clergy abuse stories over the last decades, I guess. Melanie, for somebody listening who is a survivor of this kind of abuse, who hasn't come forward yet, who hasn't sought help, do you have some thoughts, maybe some advice for them?
I think don't suffer alone and in silence. If there are family members or friends that you think would listen to you and believe you, you might start there. If you're not seeing a therapist, you might look into seeing if you can have professional help with recovery. And then reach out for, there's our group for primarily for clergy abuse survivors, but there's also other groups, RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, Incest National Network, that provides support for survivors of abuse, and whether you're, they will help both clergy abuse survivors and people who are abused in other situations. So there is help out there. Look for it. Don't just suffer. This will always be a part of your life, but you can get better.
And briefly, as a wrap up, Melanie, we've been talking about state laws in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Are you looking toward federal laws that might affect these lawsuits?
Yes, I think the federal laws right now are fairly solidly in support of child victims. It's just that people don't always realize that that's another option, particularly for those who were maybe taken across state lines. That's something you might want to look into. Contact your local FBI office to see whether you can file the criminal charges and to see if there's available. I'm not exactly sure what's available in terms of civil remedies, but I imagine it would be the same. You could sue in federal court.
Melanie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having discussion about this important issue.
That's Melanie Sakota, Survivor Support Coordinator for the Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests. She joined us for a look at proposed state laws that would extend the timeline for civil lawsuits filed by survivors of clergy sexual abuse. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Saudi Arabia's Golf League is merging with the established PGA, raising concerns about sports washing, Saudi human rights abuses, and the future of the game in the U.S. and around the world. We'll find out what's going on, and you can weigh in. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.